watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The Abu Ghraib atrocities have been portrayed as the work of a handful of low-level sadists who broke the rules, in spite of the evidence that the responsibility not only goes all the way up the chain of command, but is standard procedure all over Iraq, Afghanistan, and in the Guantanamo Bay prison. During the Vietnam War, a massacre of villagers in My Lai became similarly notorious, and was also dealt with officially as an aberration of an isolated group of soldiers. But atrocities, then as now, are routine, generation after generation, and the people who commit them are mostly normal people who would never have dreamed of doing what they did before their military service. The goal of the Eyes Wide Open exhibit that was recently in Ithaca is to make visible to people the realities of war and militarism. As part of that series of events, a panel of local veterans of wars from Vietnam to Iraq spoke about their experiences following the showing of Winter Soldier, a 1971 documentary about the Vietnam War. On the program this week, we'll hear a portion of that powerful film, and then the panel that followed it. In February 1971, 1 month after the revelations of the My Lai massacre, a public inquiry into war crimes committed by American forces in Vietnam was held at a Howard Johnson motel in Detroit. Vietnam Veterans Against the War organized this event called the Winter Soldier Investigation. More than 125 veterans spoke of atrocities they had witnessed and committed. Though the event was attended by press and television news crews, almost nothing was reported to the American public. But these veterans attempting to confront their past and reclaim their humanity marked a turning point in the anti-war movement. The film begins as veterans check in and interviewers determine where they served and what they're able to testify to.
Age? 27.
Military training.
As a helicopter pilot.
Oh, no. OCS?
No. No. Marine Aviation Cadet.
Marquette.
Marquette.
Rank. Well, the highest rank attained. Whip it on us, baby.
Highest rank attained? Captain.
Woo! I see duty period now.
August 66, September 67.
Have you ever witnessed any of the following? One prisoner shot?
I don't know whether I have or not, offhand.
This one might be apropos. Prisoners thrown from helicopters.
Yeah, I've seen that. I've never seen them thrown out of my airplane because it's behind me, but we had a couple of guys from Philadelphia in our squadron who used to blindfold the guys with safety wire and pull them real tight, so this copper wire is tearing into their eyes and nose, and bind their hands with safety wire, and used to have contests seeing how far they could throw the bound bodies out of the airplane, and you know, throw one as far as you can and see if you can get the other one farther.
If you could approximate how many instances have you come across this?
Of that? In the two-digit numbers, say. Somewhere between 15 and 50, probably.
Some of these people
weren't necessarily either Kong or NBA. Some could be VCS.
You never know. Yeah. You never know. They're if they're alive, they're VCS automatically. If they're dead, then they're confirmed VC.
Were you ever issued orders on taking prisoners or disposing?
We were told, do not count prisoners when you're loading them on board the aircraft. Count them when you unload them. Which the naive young Brown Bar says, well, why? What difference does it make? And the wizened old first lieutenant says, because the numbers may not jive. And sure enough, you don't count them when they're getting on, because there was a little bit of a feeling here. The guy who told me this was a captain. And he said, don't ever, ever count them when they go aboard, because presumably you'd have to say something if one of them got thrown out.
Give your name, what unit you were in, and when you were in the NOM. You know, just tell a little bit of what you saw to make it more clear, you know, exactly what happened.
The people were in the village. They, you know, like they wanted time to get their goods out and shit, but we just burned down the village and they had to leave their goods there or get burned.
You might be able to come up with that. I was trying to find somebody that knew something about a Ville wiped out in Quang Tri.
Right, I was there.
You got that.
Because that was, we went into the area, and it was to set the example to show that we weren't fucking around. So the first thing we do was burn down the village and kill everybody.
See,
just to let them know.
And everybody was talking about it when I got there.
Yeah.
This is gonna...
That was one of the last ones we did. Because then I went home after that. On Operation Stone, we were sitting up on a railroad trestle, and then there was a river on each side, and there was another company behind each river. And, like, the people were running around inside, and we were just shooting them. And, like, the newspaper said, Operation Stone, like World War II movie, you know. And we just sat up there, and we wiped them out, women, children, everything. 291 of them.
Is there something that you really kind of want to say in terms of the crimes and why they happened?
What bothers you most?
I mean, what sort of makes you... What brings you here? What makes you say, I want to testify, I want to say something?
I'd almost need a book to answer that, man. It's like just so many things bothered me about just that short period that I was over there. And the whole 2 years I was in the Army. I didn't like being an animal, and I didn't like seeing everybody else turn into animals either. And I just sort of hope that in a way I can sort of relate what I saw over there to what's happening here, because no matter how much we as veterans can relate to the press or to the public, until you've grasped it, man, you're not going to end that war, because it's too distant. A man on the street's too busy making a buck here, and he's too worried about getting antifreeze for his car. I'm just getting to a point that it's sort of making me quiet, you know? Sort of making it like I don't know what to say anymore. They've all heard it, and they all know what's happening, but it's like nothing's happening. You're supposed to feel sorry for American wounded, but you weren't supposed to feel sorry for the enemy wounded or dead. And I just felt sorry for the whole thing. But I guess that doesn't mean anything, just feeling sorry about it. I think what I'd really like to testify about is that it's just hurt a whole generation of Americans and Vietnamese, and that's the biggest atrocity.
The media wants to capitalize, I think, on all these veterans getting together and testifying on all these atrocities. You know, we want to get into the atrocities, but we also want to get into, you know, what are we doing over there in the first place, you know? How do these atrocities get to be committed? You know, they just don't happen. There's the whole thing of how they tell you, you know, that the people over there aren't really people.
And it's not, one guy just hasn't been doing a, you know, it's been pretty much established policy.
The front dude got up and wrapped all the shit, they hang him. But they can't deny the testimony of all these dudes in the room.
The first day I got to Vietnam, I landed in Da Nang Air Base, got off the plane, and hitchhiked on Highway 1 to my new unit, I was picked up by a truckload of grunt Marines with two company grade officers, first lieutenants. We were about 5 miles down the road where there were some Vietnamese children at the gateway of the village, and they gave the old finger gesture at us. It was understandable that they picked us up from the GIs there. They stopped the truck. They slowed down a little bit, And it was just like response. The guys got up, including the lieutenants, and just blew all the kids away. There was about 5 or 6 kids blown away there. And then the truck just moved, continued down the hill. That was my first day in Vietnam. In Quang Tri City, I had a friend who was, he was working with USAID, and one time he asked me would I like to accompany him to watch. He was an advisor with an Arvin group, and he asked me if I would like to accompany him into a village that I was familiar with to see how they act. So I went with them, and they didn't find any enemy, but they found a woman with bandages. So she was questioned with about, she was questioned by 6 Arvins, and the way they questioned her was since she had bandages, they shot her. She was hit about 20 times. So after she was questioned, of course dead, this guy come over who was, and knowing him, he was a former major. He was in the service for 20 years, and he got hungry again and came back over working with USAID, AIDS International Development. And he went over there and ripped her clothes off and took a knife and cut from her vagina all the way up, well, just about up to her breast, and pulled her organs out completely out of her cavity and threw them out. And then he stopped and knelt over and commenced to peel every bit of skin off her body and left her there as a sign for something or other.
In one village, we wounded women and kids going into the village. And when we got in there, this was in Tuiwa also, when we got in the village, me and another guy, we were treating 2 unconscious babies, not babies, but like 5, 6-year-old kids, and a woman lying in a hammock. And I told the lieutenant, these people have to be evacuated, because if they're not evacuated, this lady had shrapnel on her, and the kids had shrapnel on them, and they were unconscious. I said, if they're not evacuated, they're going to die. He said, well, forget it, Doc. We don't have time to stay here and wait. And we went up on the hill right above this same village, and we fired down on this village the next day while people were trying to bury their dead. We fired down on the village at the people while they were doing their burial ceremony, and they killed another VC. Not VC, but another person in the village. Also, we went down that same day to get some water, and there were 2 little boys playing on a dike, and one sergeant just took his M16 and shot one boy off the dike. The other boy tried to run, and he was almost out of sight. This other guy, Spec 4, he shot this other little boy off the dike, and the little boy was like lying on the ground kicking, so he shot him again to make sure he's dead. Then we went into the village, and this Papa-san there, I don't know if he was a village chief or who he was, but he came up to us, and he was telling us that he was making motions, a bird, you know, was flying over, and the bird took a shit, and the thing went boom, boom. And he was saying this is how, like, a lot of people in the village got hurt.
I think every person that was in Vietnam was in the infantry used CS, which is a gas, chemicals, Willie Peter, that's white phosphorus, and we used these sometimes to clear bunkers, and other times to destroy a hooch before we'd go into a village or something, if we thought it might be VC infested or something like this, we'd send in Willie Peter mortars, 60 millimeters, and this would burn up the hooches that explode, throwing white phosphorus on different hooches in the village, start the hooches burning, and also kill people. It's probably one of the worst sights I've ever seen is a person that's been burned by Willie Peter, because it doesn't stop. It just burns all completely through your body. The only way you can end this burning is to cut off the air. It's very difficult.
If I could get back to the Vietnamese woman I saw that was mutilated so horribly, it didn't really shock me, because I think I talked about my first day in Vietnam. You can check with the Marines who've been to Vietnam. Your last day in the States, the staging battalion at Camp Pendleton, you have a little lesson. It's called the rabbit lesson, where the staff NCO comes out and he has a rabbit. And he's talking to you about escape and evasion and survival in the jungle. And he has this rabbit, and then in a couple of seconds, everyone just about falls in love with it. Not falls in love with it, but, you know, they're humane there. He cracks it in the neck, skins it, disembowels it, just like I sit... testified that this happened to a woman. He does this to a rabbit, and then they throw the guts out in the audience. And you can get anything out of that you want, but that's your last lesson you catch in the United States before you leave for Vietnam.
You have some testimony here on the burning of villages,
cutting off of ears, cutting off of heads, calling artillery on villages for games, women raped, napalm on villages. Could you go into just a few of these to let the people know how you treat the Vietnamese civilians?
The calling in of artillery for games, the way it was worked, would be the mortar forward observers would call in, or we'd pick out certain houses in villages, friendly villages, and the mortar forward observers would call in mortars until they destroyed that house. And then the artillery forward observer would call in artillery until he destroyed another house. And whoever used the least amount of artillery, they won. And then when we got back, someone would have to buy someone else beers. And I saw one case where there were two prisoners, and one prisoner was staked out on the ground, and he was cut open while he was alive. And part of his insides were cutting out. And they told the other prisoner, if he didn't tell them what they wanted to know, that they would kill him. And I don't know what he said because he spoke in Vietnamese, but then they killed him after that anyway.
All right, were these primarily civilians, or do you believe that they were, or do you know that they were actual
The way NBA. That we distinguished between civilians and VC, VC had weapons and civilians didn't, and anybody that was dead was considered a VC. If you killed someone, they said, how do you know he's a VC? The general reply would be, he's dead, and that was sufficient. The cutting off of heads on Operation Stone, there was a lieutenant colonel there, and two people had their heads cut off and put on stakes and stuck in the middle of the field. And we were notified that there were press covering the operation and that we couldn't do that anymore.
The general attitude of the officers was, I was a lieutenant at the time, well, there's somebody senior to me here, and I guess if this wasn't SOP, he'd be doing something to stop it. And since nobody senior ever did anything to stop it, the policy was promulgated, and everybody assumed that this was what was right. We'd never had any instruction in the Geneva Convention. When we were given our Geneva Convention cards, the lecture consisted of, if you're taken prisoner, all you got to do is give them your name, rank, serial number, and date of birth. Here's your Geneva Convention cards. Go get them, Marines. We were never told anything about the way to treat prisoners, if we were the capturers rather than the captee.
I saw one case where a woman was shot by a sniper, one of our snipers. And when we got up to her, she was asking for water. And the lieutenant said to kill her. So they ripped off her clothes. They stabbed her in both breasts. They spread her eagle and shoved an E-tool up her vagina, an entrenching tool, and she was still asking for water. And then they took that out and they used a tree limb, and then she was shot.
Did the men in the in your outfit, did they seem to think that the it was all right to do anything to the Vietnamese?
It wasn't like they were humans. Like, we were, you know, we were conditioned to believe that, you know, this was for the good of the nation, the good of our country, and anything we did was okay. And like, when you shot someone, you didn't think you were shooting a human. They were a gook or a commie, and it was okay.
The Vietnamese were gooks. They were all... we didn't just call the VC or the NVA gooks. All Vietnamese were gooks, and they were slant eyes, zips. They were Orientals, and they were inferior to us. So we were Americans. We were the civilized people, and you know, we didn't give a shit about those people.
At the time, did you have any question in your mind that anything wrong was going on?
Well, something like this was just too bad. You know, I mean, it was all wrong. You know. It's just that I didn't start really thinking about these things until I came home, because I had to get my head together to start, you know, almost to get up the guts to start talking about this thing, you know, because I've been holding in it for a long time.
I'll throw this question out to anybody. I have heard soldiers testify to personal atrocities that they committed, and yet the fact that they're here means that they're concerned. What happens to a man over in Vietnam?
Well, it's our general conditioning, even before we get in the service. You know, America's always right, the government's right, you don't question them, we're the best, God's on our side. And things like what happened at Hiroshima and Nagasaki showed it's okay to kill civilians if it's for the best interest of the nation. And when I went there, I went twice, and I believed that it was in the best interest of the nation. And I was sufficiently brainwashed where I did go back the second time, because I really believed it was right.
You didn't feel that morally you shouldn't carry out some of these orders?
I felt whatever was in the best interest of my country was what was best, and that's how I was raised to believe.
When people see on their television screen films of those who have testified during the Winter Soldier investigation, they're going to see a lot of people with long hair, a lot of people with beards. Don't you think this is going to turn them off and they're going to disregard a lot of what you say? You're an intelligent fellow, I believe you.
It's possible. For 6 years, my hair never got longer than a quarter of an inch, and I always swore I'd keep it that short, but I like it long now. It feels nice. When I was in the Marine Corps, and when I first got out of the Marine Corps, I didn't want to talk to anybody who didn't think that Agnew sitteth at the right hand of God. If I was walking down the center of Cambridge, where I live, and some long-haired kid was walking toward me, and he wouldn't get out of the way, I'd knock his ass right into the gutter. And one day, I did that, and a kid said to me, "That makes it sort of hard for us to get to know each other." And I thought that was a joke, and I kept on walking. And I was lying in bed, talking with my wife, and she said, "You know, he's really right." Which was, you know, a simple thing, and I could have, that might have gone right over me and never affected me whatsoever. But my wife has a fantastic way of helping me and teaching me how to enjoy life. And that's the key to growing and being a better person is talking to people who are different, not to people who are the same.
I didn't like school in high school. It took me 4 years to finish 3 years of high school because I was never there. And when I was young, in high school, the big thing to do was every weekend we'd get drunk and we'd go rumble the Cubans at the dance. And we lived in Miami, and that was the thing, you know. And I had 7 counts of assault and battery, and a 3-year sentence to Rayford, which was suspended. And I had to go in the service, and I went in the Marines for 4 years.
What do you mean you had to go in the service?
Well, it was just I was on probation, and then I got in another fight. So they were going to, you know, just pull the rug out from under me. And my lawyer told the judge that it would be better if I went in the service, and they'd fix me up. If I went in jail, I'd be bad to society when I came out.
Did you want to go in the service, Scott?
I did, but not as soon. I wanted to go in the service because I really believed that the war was right. And I think one of the main things was I wanted to see for myself whether I was really a man or not. And I figured that's how I could find out. And like people were trying to save me, you know, and they'd say, you know, you'll really find God overseas, you know. When you really need him, you'll find him. And I wanted to see what kind of a person I really was. Was I really brave? Was I a chicken? And I believed in the war, and I believed, you know, the best thing a person could do was give his life for his country. So I went in the Marine Corps, and I got to Paris Island, and they really changed my head around. I was, if I thought I could have escaped, I would have.
Were you good at it?
No, they broke two of my teeth, because I didn't conform as quickly as I was supposed to. And,
Well, can you talk about the specific incident?
Yeah, we were supposed to run 3 miles before each meal and 3 miles after each meal with full packs. And I just couldn't see throwing up my meal, you know. And in boot camp, you're not allowed to talk without permission. And for instance, if I wanted to go to the bathroom, I would say, "Sir, Private Camille requests permission to speak, sir." And he'd say, "What do you want, turd?" And I'd say, "Sir, Private Camille requests permission to make a head call, sir." And he'd say, "Is it an emergency?" And I'd say, "Yes, sir." And then he had alternatives what he could do. He could say, "Okay, go around the room 3 times with your siren to prove it's an emergency." And you'd have to run around the room going, and if you didn't do it fast, you know, loud enough, then it wasn't really an emergency. Or else he could say, "Okay, we'll wait 1 hour. And if you don't go, then you lie to me. And then I'm going to kick your ass." So, like, you had a choice of either pissing in your pants or getting your ass kicked. And, like, there, you know, things that normally didn't happen to you, and it's kind of bad for your head. And if I would have gotten out of there, I would have. So the day we were running, I didn't run. I just started walking. And if the man in front of you falls down, you have to run him over. If you go around him, you get beat up. Because if he knows you're going to run him over, he won't fall down. So I just stepped out to the side and let them all run past me and started walking. And they said,
run, you know. He says, what's your name? I said, Private Camille, sir. He says, you better start running. I says, I'm tired. And he says, get up in the barn, you're going to be sorry. I said, I'm already sorry. So I went up there, and they called where we lived the barn. And they were going to send me to Motivation Platoon. That's where they, that makes boot camp seem like Sunday school. So then they said, okay, we'll handle it in the closet motivation. So I went in the closet, and the two of them came in. They said, about face, and I turned around, and two fists hit me. And I didn't even fight back. I said, okay, you know, I give up, I'll run. So when I got done, like the last day of boot camp, they said, now you've earned the name Marines, now you're men, you know. And I was really gung-ho, and I was ready to sign up for 50 years, you know, because I thought the worst part was over. And then I went to Vietnam. In my third week in Vietnam, I was standing guard on an artillery base, and there were 16 of us on guard, four in each corner of the base. And our grenades were taped up, so if the pins came out by accident, the spoons wouldn't fly and no one would get hurt. And our rifles weren't allowed to be loaded, and the rules were we couldn't load without permission and we couldn't fire without permission. And if you saw something, you'd call the sergeant of the guard in the guard shack. Well, the sergeant of the guard walked around and checked to make sure people weren't sleeping. And when he was going around, the gooks got him. So then when the people saw the gooks inside the fence, they asked for permission and there was no one there and they didn't fire. So they just wiped us out. And my post was the only post they didn't take. They took the other three posts. And as soon as I saw them, like, I wasn't going to ask anybody. We just started shooting. And we stacked up 40 bodies inside the perimeter, inside the fence. And we had 28 men wounded, 5 men killed, and 5 105 howitzers, those are big artillery guns, destroyed by this suicide thing. And I wrote my congressman and asked him how come we couldn't have our weapons loaded and how come we needed permission to fire and things like that. And a few people in my outfit got relieved.
Is that the first time that you killed
anyone? That was the first time I killed anyone. And the next morning, I looked at my 5 friends that were dead. And I pulled the sheets off of them and I looked at them real close. And then I said, you know, like, you know, this is really real. Someone wants to really kill me. And, you know, if I make one mistake, I don't get another chance. So I can't make any mistakes. And that's what I said. And I decided at that point that I would kill anyone I could, you know, knowing whether they were innocent or not, just to make sure I wouldn't get killed. And that was my philosophy. Like, if I'd go into a village and have to kill 100 people just to make sure there was no one there to shoot me when I walked out, that's what I did. And that's what I did when I was there.
Do you feel that your boot camp training sort of prepared you for that kind of attitude at all?
Well, in boot camp, we used to, every night we had to say, before we went to bed, we'd have to sing the Marine Corps hymn. And it was laying in attention in bed, we'd sing the Marine Corps hymn, and then we'd say, another day in the Corps, sir, for every day's a holiday, and every meal's a feast. Pray for war. Pray for war. God bless the Marine Corps. God bless my drill instructors. Pray for war. And every night we had to say that. And when we'd run and we'd sing songs, we'd sing, like they say, kill, kill, kill. And when we, at our judo practice and knife fighting practice and bayonet fighting practice, it was always, that was the yell, kill, kill, kill. And, you know, boy, you're going to get to go over there and kill some gooks, you know. And it was something that we were looking forward to, you know, put our training to use. And serve our nation's best interest. Well, we thought it was our nation's best interest.
Due to the fact that one of the men has to leave very shortly, Nathan Hale, I'd like to let him testify to the interrogation procedures at this time.
I arrived at the base camp of the 1st of the 1st Cav, which is Hill 29. When I arrived there, my S2, my captain, told me that my job was to elicit information. And this meant that I could elicit information in any means possible. He told me that I can use any technique I can think of, and the idea is don't get caught. And what he meant was I could beat these people, I could cut them, I could probably shoot them. I never shot anyone, but I could use any means possible to get information. Just don't beat them in the presence of a non-unit member or person. That's someone like a visiting officer or perhaps the Red Cross. And I personally used clubs, rifle butts, pistols, knives, and This was always done at Hill 29. The important point here is that everything I did was always monitored. An interrogator is always monitored. I was monitored by an MP sergeant at Hill 29, who often helped me in my interrogations, he and his squad. This is a group of detainees being brought in. Okay, there's an interrogation going on right here. It's a big production. These are all the Marines sitting around giving the various cheers. This man here is a warrant officer. This just shows, a typical Vietnamese who's bound. These are National Field Police. This man came over and put a tin spoon, it's a Vietnamese spoon, and he put it in my fire, and he's burning the skin off of the back of the man's neck. And finally, the man, in fear of his life, admitted that at one time he had given tax to the VC, but you can't prove that. I heard earlier today that they used CS. Well, the Marines used a lot of CS. This particular man wouldn't come out of the hole, and they threw two CS grenades in. I personally escorted this man back to division, and he died. So if gas doesn't kill, I don't know what killed him.
Murphy, let me ask you a question. How did you encourage information from the from your detainees or from the prisoners that you captured in the field?
Well, first of all, we would ask them. And if we didn't get the information, or if they said they didn't know anything, we figured they were lying, well, we'd go to torture. And by torture, I mean first time I ever saw it used, the first time was on Operation Junction City 1. We were over by the Cambodian border in War Zone C. We had just walked into a ambush, and out of this ambush we had about approximately 15 casualties. Out of that, we had about 5 killed out of those 15. We picked up 5 or 6 prisoners, and while flying them back, going to our fire support base, we had a lieutenant that had been in country about 5 days. And he said that he was going to conduct the interrogation. So we were explaining to him that we had qualified people in the rear to do this, but he told us to shut up. He was a lieutenant. So, boom, that ended that. So he asked 2 or 3 questions, and all of them kept saying, no Bic, moolah or something.
Explain what that means to the...
I don't know. I'm not going to tell you I don't know. I believe this, I don't know. Then he ordered for the door to be open, the middle door. And just without another word, he just pushed one out. And then he started asking, he said, are you going to tell me now? And he started, put his gun on him. So all this time we're looking at it. And we're kind of mad, too, because we had been out there and some of our friends had been killed or wounded. And at the time, it really didn't mean anything to us. He pushed out another one. And now the third one he came to, he started to saying something in Vietnamese and pointing to the one of them on the end. And as we found out after searching this fellow, that he was a lieutenant in the North Vietnamese Army. And on the way in after this, he said if anything was said about this, he would make it harder on us. Okay, so he wrote himself up for a medal by detaining, getting information from prisoners, and saving us from walking into another ambush, evidently. But he received a Bronze Star with a V device in it for valor. The V stood for valor. We started going on little missions, search and destroy missions, in Olan K. And we ran into a few NVA that came to us. What was the word? Dung?
Chu Hoi.
And right on the spot we're taking the prisoners, a lieutenant came up and said it's a 3-day pass for any body. If you can prove that you've killed an NVA, you have a 3-day pass to Vong Tau. That's the in-country R&R center. And right there at that point, I actually, with my eyes, I saw a first sergeant and a lieutenant actually fight over who the prisoners were killed. They were taken and killed right there on the spot. But who killed them? They just started to fight right there. And it's been quite a few incidents like that that I couldn't recall, but everybody up here, we said just about the same thing. But I have helped in torturing prisoners. And at one time, we thought it was showing courage or bravery or whatever you want to call it. We wore ears. We did. We'd take them and catch them while they were alive, take an ear, because, see, the Vietnamese people believe if they die without all of their body, that they won't go to Buddha heaven. And we would do this to two or three of them to get information from the rest of them.
Thank you.
The first slide you're going to see shows a prisoner of war, and the way that they try to get him to talk is by making him stand in front of a pile of Viet Cong bodies that we had picked up. It's the same POW was forced to sit for probably from 6 to 8 hours by this pile of bodies in the hot sun. It's a shot of 5 or 6 GIs going through the bodies looking for souvenirs. In this picture, there's a lieutenant and a captain overlooking what's going on. This is a shot of our interrogator. He took his M16. He took him and forced him into this prisoner's nose. And he twists him. It's extremely painful.
Officers were present at all times.
Yes, field grade officers were present. And the next slide is a slide of myself. I'm extremely shameful of it. I'm showing it in hopes that none of you people that have never been involved ever let this happen to you. Don't ever let your government do this to you. It's me holding a dead body, smiling.
I think one of the biggest ways the guys would personally fight the army or any policy was what is termed malingering or shamming. Any way you could damage yourself. Guys, the first time I walked into my unit, I walked in and a brother was laying on a bed, stoned out of his mind, and another brother came down with a bat on his leg, broke it right in front of me. And I said, what's happening? And he says, home, you just go out and hump the bush for a while and you'll find out. And you're scared. You're so scared that you'll shoot anything. You'll look at your enemy. You'll look at them as animals. And in the same time, you're just turning yourself into an animal, too. And I'd say that's got my head spinning a little right now, the fact that I was actually one time an animal, and that now I have to come back and be civil again. And people sort of expect a purpose and expect you just to have a definite purpose. You know, are you going to school? Yeah. Are you going to work? Yeah. But, like, there's just more and more veterans now that are just finding that there's no purpose because nobody's ever given us one. The only purpose I had was surviving and getting the hell out. And that's about all I can say unless anybody wants to ask anything.
I just know that, and we learned somewhere along the line that a dink was less than a person. And these things go on. They really happen. I don't know how to... Man, I can't talk. I can't tell you people. Incidences or whatever you want to hear. I'm just here because it goes on and somebody's got to do something. And here I am, you know.
I can't really say why we did it. Maybe it was because we were taught to hate him. I was told by my own lieutenant, well, he saw me wearing one of these bracelets. He asked me why I was wearing it. I told him, I said, well, a Vietnamese boy gave it to me. I said he was a token of his friendship, really. He liked me and I liked him. We gave each other gifts, I suppose. And he told me to take it off. And of course I didn't agree. I didn't want to take it off. I didn't feel I should. But he told me these are the same people. He says, why do you accept gifts from the same people that go out and put mines in the roads and blow up your buddies? And he told me if I didn't take it off, he'd go to more, maybe drastic measures. I don't know. He just dismissed me. But, I don't know. I don't want to give any blood stories or nothing. I just can't do it. I just want you to know that the people over there aren't really being treated as human beings. They're being treated as slaves, let's say. Maybe not even slaves. I don't know. I don't know. I just don't know what to say. I just wanted you to know about it.
When you go to Vietnam, you're prepared to play the Marine Corps role. You're assuming the role as a professional Marine, a killer, whatever, and you're going to play that out exactly the way it's been defined to you.
Things like this here work on the mind. And if they can deteriorate portions of the mind for any period of time, see, then they could just about gear you into doing anything they want.
In fact, I was so weird after Vietnam, I carried a pistol around my back pocket, for no apparent reason to myself for 6 months until one day I pulled it on somebody at school. My duty was to go out and serve as a perimeter guard on the Dong Ha ramp. And this was an LCU ramp on the Qua Viet River where Navy ships came up and they'd offload supplies. And we took our truck with outside the combat base every night at 5:30 to set up at the ramp for our night's duty. And we used to drive by this row of hooches, and a little three-year-old kid in dirty gray shorts used to run out and scream, "You Marines, number 10!" And we'd always go back, "Oh, kid," you know, all this stuff. So one night, the kid comes out and says, "Marine, you're number 10," throws a rock. So we figured we'd get him, because this was a way of having fun. And the next night before we went out, we all stopped by COC, which is right by the ammo dump, picked up the biggest rocks we could get our hands on, and piled it in the back of the truck. So when we left the combat base, we just turned the corner, and we saw a little kid. We were waiting for the kid. He ran out of the hooch, and he's going to scream, "Marine number 10, and we didn't even let him get it out of his mouth. He just picked up all the rocks and smeared him. We just wiped him out. In fact, the force of the rocks was enough to knock over his little tin hooch as well. And, I don't know, I can't say that the kid died, but if it would have been me, I would have died easily. The rocks, some of them were easily as big as his head. And it was looked upon as funny. We all laughed about it. And then we forgot about it. And it took me about a year to even be able to recall the situation. I think it said something about the entire attitude of us over there. I never had a specific hatred for the Vietnamese. I just tended to ignore them. They didn't figure in any calculation as to being human. They just either got in the way or they weren't there. It used to be a game we'd play. We'd pour garbage, liquid garbage, off the end of our truck to make them crawl for it. Mama-sans would come up with half-cut 50-gallon drums, and they try and fill it up. They get pork chops and sloppy rice and mystery meat or wop slop, whatever we'd had for chow, and put it in there, and then we'd let them walk so far, and then we'd tip it over, spill it on the ground, and watch them scrape the dirt in there. Anything to dehumanize them.
In the time I was there, nobody ever got hurt in the garbage dump, as far as Americans. But a lot of Vietnamese women and children were hurt. And it was fair game between Con Thien going through the city of Cam Lo on the outskirts of Quang Tri going to Stud, that American troops would stock up on their heavies, their spaghetti and meatballs and ham and lima beans. And any little children who were begging along the side of the road, which never numbered less than 50 or 60, were a fair game for these full cans of food. They wouldn't throw them to the kids. They'd just bounce them off their heads or try to knock them off their bicycles.
These people are aware of what American soldiers do to them, so naturally they try to hide the young girls. We found one hiding in a bomb shelter in the basement of her house. She was taken out, raped by 6 or 7 people in front of her family. In front of most of the villagers. This wasn't just one instance. This is just the first one that I could remember. But I know of 10 or 15 of such instances at least. The gentleman on my left can corroborate my testimony, as we were together the whole time, served in the same squad in the same company.
At the time most of this happened, our platoon leader was a Mormon minister. He's dead now, so he can't really be found out and questioned. But when he got there, he was pretty well high character man because he was a minister. And by the time he left, well, by the time he got killed, rather, he was condoning everything that was going on because it was a part of policy. If nobody tells you that it's wrong, then you do it anyway. And this is how it changed him around.
Once we were picking up a sling load of ammunition, and the Army had a habit of putting pickup zones and drop-off zones right near well-traveled roads, roads traveled by the local villagers. So we were hovering over this sling load of, I think it was howitzer rounds. And I was hanging out the window observing what appeared to be about, I guess he was about 12-year-old Vietnamese boy standing there watching us. And as we lifted up with the load, the rotor wash increased because of the weight, and it blew him into the path of a 2.5-ton truck with trailer, which killed him instantly. When that happened, my first reaction, and my flight engineer, he was observing this too. Our first reaction was, I guess you'd call normal. It would be horror, pain. And then I realized that I caught myself immediately, and I said, no, you can't do that because you develop a shell while you're in the military. They brainwash you. They take all the humanness out of you. And you develop this crust which enables you to survive in Vietnam. And if you let that protective shell down, even for a second, it could mean that it's the difference between you flipping out or managing to make it through. And I caught myself letting the shell down, and I tightened up right away and started laughing about it and joking about it with the flight engineer. And he sort of moved on the same logic because I guess he caught, it sort of knocked his shell down too. In one incident, we were flying and we took fire from 6 NVA, which caused the ship to explode in the air and make a crash landing. Now, on the way down, because our company policy was to just keep on firing, I looked out across the field and I spotted a Vietnamese woman, a peasant, running away from the ship. I fired a burst of about 6 or 7 rounds into her back before we fired, before we hit the ground. When I was being questioned as to what happened about 2 weeks later by a captain in my company, I told him what we did and what I did, and we both had a good laugh about it. That was pretty much company policy.
I saw a lot of things happening and being done by guys, and I really, like the emotional thing, you see your buddy get killed, and it's really emotional, someone you're really good friends with. Like, one minute he's telling you, well, I got a letter from my girl, and I'm really happy, and I can't wait to see her. And she's going to send me some pictures she's taken. She's getting her girlfriend to take some nice Polaroid pictures of me, And then you go out, and he gets shot in the head. And, it was really hard for you to realize that, 5 minutes ago he was your friend, and now he's dead. And you'd put him on the helicopter and just make believe he went home. You try not to think that he was killed. And then you say, well, I'm going to get the gooks for it. And you just take it out on all the gooks. And it got to be where it was like someone would say, okay, you come stay on my farm and you can go hunting every day for free and I'll give you all the ammo you want. And you can hunt and there's no limit. And you can go out together and just hunt, And that's what it was like, a hunting trip. And the more people we killed, the happier our officers were, It got to be like a game. Like, the object was to see who could kill the most people. And the different ways you could prove how many people you killed would be like cutting off ears. Now, if you brought back someone's ears, pretty likely you had to kill them to get them. And then people would, whoever had the most ears, they would get the most beers. And you'd trade your ears for beers. And it got to be like a game. And when it came time to go home, I was very close to my friends, and I got where I knew what I was doing, like I was like an expert. My job being a forward observer is also a scout sergeant, and you have to learn to read maps and know the area. And I got where I knew where I was without looking at the maps, and I could call in artillery just by knowing where I was. And I was really attached to my friends. I couldn't see leaving my friends and going home. And then I thought about the political thing again. I said, well, and I wrote my mother a letter. I told her, I said, I'm not coming home in April because I really believe what we're doing is right. and I think it's better for me to stay here and help get it cleaned up if I can than for my brother to have to come over when he gets old enough. And that's what I wrote, and that's what was put in the newspaper, and they had a big article, you know, we need more Americans like this.
What was your rank when you first went over?
A PFC.
And when did you left?
A sergeant. I made a lance corporal, corporal, and sergeant. I made a very good rank.
So you'd say the Army thought you were a good soldier?
I got a good conduct medal, too, and I got the Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry with Silver Star, and got put up for the Bronze Star 3 times. Another time, I had a friend of mine killed, and I was very upset. And I asked this Vietnamese for his ID card, and he said, "Cam Biak," and that means I don't understand in Vietnamese. And it just pissed me off, so I pulled out my knife and I killed him. And it didn't bother me at all. I just called in, I said, "One VC killed." And they said, "How do you know he's a VC?" And I said, "Because he's dead." And they laughed and said, "Okay," you know. And I'd come in and people would ask me what's going on out in the front, and I'd tell them. And they'd keep it short for how many kills you have, and I'd come in and they'd show me how many I have. And what it is, every time you kill someone, you have to report it. And you have to search them for papers and stuff. But this is something else, body count. If 10 of us would go out and I'd come back with only 5 men, we'd lost half our men. And you couldn't say that you didn't see any enemy. So you could have only killed 1 enemy. And by the time it would get up to the high command, you know, you killed 50 of them, because they couldn't say that they lost 5 men taking 1. So the body count's a bunch of shit.
Did you think that that was a justifiable thing? I mean, there you knew there was a lie, but did you see a reason for it at the time?
I didn't question it. Like, I figured, well, if the people home think we're killing them, you know, that's great, because that's what we're supposed to be doing. And another thing is the competition between units. Besides competition between men to kill the most, there's competition between squads and between companies and battalions to see who can kill the most. So, like, if the newspaper said Charlie Company got 200 kills and we didn't get any, we weren't going to say anything, man. We wanted them to think, we're bad guys, man. And we thought we were so tough, we went around with aces of spades in our helmets. And every time we'd kill someone, we'd put it in their face. So if anyone else came, they knew that Charlie Company did it, you know.
Going along with what Scott said, they didn't care what you were doing or how you were getting it. They wanted bodies. And that's where civilians came in also. In November of 68, in an area called the Wagon Wheel, which is northwest of Saigon, while on a routine search and destroy mission, gunships were to be providing security and cover for us in case we had any contact, were circling overhead. Well, no contact was made, and the gunships got bored. So they made a gun run on a hooch with miniguns and rockets. When they left the area, we found 1 dead baby, which was a young child. Very young, in its mother's arms. And we found a baby girl about 3 years old that were dead because these people were bored and they were just sick of flying around doing nothing. Then, as when it was reported to battalion, the only reprimand was to put the 2 bodies on the body count board and just add them up with the rest of the dead people. There was no reprimand, there was nothing. We tried to call the gunship off, and there was nothing you could do. You know, he just made his run, dropped his ordnance, and left. And there they were, man. And the mother was, of course, hysterical. How would you like it if someone came in and shot your baby? And there was nothing we could do, man. We just watched it, and nothing happened. I have no idea what happened to the helicopter pilot or to anyone in the gunship. It was gone. And things like this happen, I'm sure, more than once. Because if I saw it, I'm sure there are a lot of veterans who aren't here who saw it. And this is why we have to stop the war. Because not only are we killing our brothers in the armed forces and brothers on the other side, but we're killing innocent people, man. Innocent civilians who are just standing by and happen to be at that place at that time. And for no other reason than that, they wind up dead.
I've been in there listening to this whole thing, the whole thing tonight, man. You know what? It's relevant, man. But you know what? Even this whole thing you're doing now, it's only relevant to you, man. It ain't relevant to me. You know how come? Because you fail to realize what the reason is, man. How come? You know, Dick, you're going in there and you're getting all these reports, man, on atrocities. Yeah, man. They were splitting this cat's skull and they're splitting that skull, splitting his skull. But you know what? The real issue is, man, that the thing is racism. It's racist.
That, brother.
It's racist, man. They over there after the Vietnamese, you know, the resources. They also after the Vietnamese because they're racist, man. I had all the hell I had in the Army because of racism. You know, like, dig, man, my orderly room, man, my first sergeant, man, was a Ku Klux Klan, man. You went into the service. And you got the enemy because you couldn't get into college, so you had to go in the Army. Now, see, the reason we go in the Army is for a different reason. Because, dig, now, dig, right? Now, we get out of high school, you dig, now, we can't jump out there in the motherfucking street and go get a gig, man, because you black, you dig? The only way that a brother can live when he get out of school, if he ain't got no smart, is to go in the Army, man. Because we ain't got nowhere to go, man. That high visibility is going to keep you down all the time.
There's an aura of hate in my outfit. I mean, a Vietnamese, there's no such thing to my unit as a friendly Vietnamese. Every Vietnamese is a gook. I've hardly ever heard the term Vietnamese. They were always gooks. There's no difference between a good one and a bad one, except the good one at the time is carrying no weapon, but he's still fair game.
I looked to where the VCS were, supposed VCS, and two men were leading a young girl, approximately 19 years old, very pretty, out of a hooch. She had no clothes on, so I assumed she had been raped, which was pretty SOP, and that's standard operating procedure for civilians. And she was thrown onto the pile of the 19 women and children, and five men around the circle opened up on full automatic with their M16s. And that was the end of that.
I would like to point out that if you took the Vietnamese War, or the American War as it is, and compared it right to the Indian Wars 100 years ago, it would be the same thing. All the massacres were the same, and nowadays they use chemical warfare. Back then, they put smallpox in the blankets and gave them to the Indians. And you could just go right down the line and name them off, and they would be the same thing. And you can take any culture of these people up here on the panel, any culture out there, and if you look back into it deep, they had something good. Way back they had it. And then people started getting onto the money bag. And that's when it all happened. Well, we made treaties long ago. It was for as long as the grass shall grow and as long as the river shall flow. The way things are going now, one of these days, the grass isn't going to grow, and the river isn't going to flow.
When I first entered the service, I thought, well, sure, I'll, you know, that sounds like a good idea. I will be a hero, and just think of this, I'll have a rock-hard body, and golly. Because you'll have, when I went into the service, that's where my head was at. You know, I was the average middle-class American. You know, it was just the thing to do. And they dehumanize you so much that the enemy is no longer a human being who has a wife and a child. Or, you know, has a family life. He just becomes the enemy. And therefore, when you're confronted with this, all you think of is it's just like another target. And they've trained you to shoot targets. So when it comes right down to it, and there it is, it's not a man. It's a target. And then when you start to realize it, my God, look at this, you know, this can't be me, man, after all this time. You know, I know that I shouldn't be doing this, but, well, here I am. And I had been trying to justify them for, you know, this period of time, because I knew it wasn't right, but I had to justify it some way, because I was doing it. Then all of a sudden I realized, no, there is no justification, man. What I have done is wrong. I have to face it. I have to admit that what I have done is wrong. And now I have to try and tell other people before they make the same mistakes I made.
My brother's out of fighting. Dead and go down Viet Cong. But he don't understand why they never done him or you or me no wrong.
You've been listening to audio excerpts of the 1972 documentary Winter Soldier, chronicling the Winter Soldier investigation hearings of February 1971, organized by Vietnam Veterans Against the War, where more than 125 young Vietnam veterans testified. The film was made by a collective of young filmmakers, one of whom, Benet Rubenstein, now lives in Ithaca. and participated in the Eyes Wide Open event. The film is being re-released and will be available on video. I strongly encourage you to see it, to see these young men's faces, and also to arrange screenings in your neighborhood. For more information on how to do this, visit WinterSoldierFilm.com. WinterSoldierFilm.com. Next, we'll hear the panel that followed the screening. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner, Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville.